in this labyrinth, the Phantom of the Opera, in Eric's times, and ours. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of In This Labyrinth. I am your host, Phantom Femme, and I have what I hope will be another really interesting and awesome episode for you. And on that note, huge thanks to everyone who has downloaded and listened to episodes 1 and 2 and the tribute to Gillian Lynn so far. Thank you guys very much. Thank you all very much. That's awesome. I hope you enjoyed them. I'm glad if you did. And thank you for tuning back in for this episode 3, and I hope you'll enjoy it too. And on that note, if you have enjoyed the first 2 plus episodes of this show, and if you enjoy this one as well, I'd be ever so obliged if you could spread the word. Tell other people, tell your friends, tell fellow Phantom fans about this podcast. Give them the URL of the podcast website and the social media info, and that would be really wonderful. It would help this show grow, and that would be really fantastic. So thank you very much. I'd be most obliged if folks who've enjoyed these first 2-3 episodes could do that. So now, yeah, episode 3. As I said last episode, this is going to be part 2 of the discussion I began last episode on what I'm calling POTO, Phantom of the Opera, and the Trouble with Normal. So if you'll recall last episode, I talked a great deal about the original novel by Gaston Leroux and what I interpret it as doing with the ideas of normal and normalcy. And I went into a lot of the historical context, talked about how the idea of normal/normalcy as we know it came to be and how it was shaping the culture at the time when LaRue was writing the original novel of Phantom. And then talking about how the novel relates to or reacts to those ideas that had become so dominant in LaRue's time. So this is going to be part 2 of that discussion, where I talk about, in a similar way, the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical, where I talk about what I interpret it as doing with the ideas of normal and normalcy, how I interpret it as relating to them, and again, going into some of the historical context that I think shapes how those ideas play out in the musical. And like with last time with the discussion of the LaRue novel, I'll be putting the quotes from the stage musical libretto that I'm using in the show notes with act and scene references, so listeners can look them up and find them in context. And I'll be putting some links to references on the historical context that I'm talking about in the show notes as well. Just like I did with the bibliographic information for the disability scholar whose work on the history of normalcy I was referencing last time. And by the way, the show notes from episode 2 are finally up. They're in the blog section of the podcast website, which I'll give the URL of at the end of the episode. And sorry it took a bit longer than I had hoped it would to get them up and posted. But they're up now, and so you'll have them for reference for both that episode, the previous episode on the LaRue novel, and for this episode as well. Okay, so now let's leap into talking about the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical. So recall last episode when I talked about the LaRue novel that I talked about how it seems to me that the novel presents this real ambivalence about the idea of normal/normalcy. On one hand, the novel can be read as being very critical of the society that LaRue lived in and the way that society treated people whom it deemed abnormal. But on the other hand, It's unclear whether the novel is calling for society to be more accepting of people like Eric or wishing that Eric could somehow be normal. And you recall I said last week, I tend to read the LaRue novel as doing both at the same time. So there's this real ambivalence in the novel, at least as I read it. So now we shift forward, we fast forward 7+, almost 8 decades, to the appearance of the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical. As many listeners will know, the Lloyd Webber musical opened in London in 1986, and then on Broadway 2 years later in 1988. And what's interesting is that in the translation or in the adaptation of the story from the LaRue novel to the stage musical, it seems to me that there's a shift. It seems to me that there's a shift away from the ambivalence of the LaRue novel and toward having the musical come down much more strongly, not just on the side of being critical of society for the way it treats people it deems abnormal, but also much more strongly on the side of calling for society to be more accepting rather than wishing the Phantom could be normal. Before I get into that, though, if you'll recall in last episode, I needed to flag the issue about the different translations of the LaRue novel and which one I was working from. Well, I need to flag something similar here. Because when I talk about the stage musical, I'm going to be referring to certain elements of the set design, and I'm going to be referring to elements of the original set design by Maria Bjornson. And that's important because since the musical originally opened back in the 80s and early 90s, there's of course been the 2004 film, which has different staging and set designs, and there have also been what are known as non-replica productions, productions of the stage version that don't follow the original staging and set design and do different things with it. Most notably, the current U.S. touring production, and I believe also the current U.K. touring production, also incorporates the same changes because it's by the same director as the current U.S. touring production. So, for example, when I talk, as I will be doing, about the Phantom's Lair, I'm referring to that set as originally designed and conceived of by Maria Bjornson. So, if what I'm talking about doesn't match what you've seen on stage, that's why. And I'll be talking about some of those differences, some of those changes in later episodes, because frankly, I find some of them quite problematic when considered from an intersectional disability social justice perspective. So, for example, next episode, I'll be talking about the changes from the stage version, the original stage version, to the 2004 film. And I'll definitely be talking about some of the changes made in other non-replica productions in later episodes still. So having prefaced it by saying all that, now I can get back to how, as I said before, in the translation of the story to the stage musical, that there's a shift away from the ambivalence and ambiguity of the LaRue novel toward having the stage musical come down much more strongly on the side of calling for society to be more accepting of people like the Phantom. And in doing so, in dropping the wish that Eric could somehow be normal as a way to solve the issue of his exclusion from society, it seems to me that the musical then becomes much more critical, takes much more of a critical position on the idea, on the whole idea of normalcy, etc. So there's a number of elements of the musical that come together to add up to this shift. First of all, although not in order of appearance, there's the final lair, Act 2, Scene 9, which is more or less equivalent to chapters 21, 22 through 26 of LaRue, D'Amato's translation. The final confrontation, fans often call it the final lair, both because it's the final scene and because it's the final time that you see the Phantom's lair. So if you'll recall in LaRue, in chapters 22 and 23, during that final confrontation sequence, Eric, the Phantom, describes how he's tired of living outside of society and he wants to be and to live, quote, like everybody else, unquote, or, quote, like anybody, unquote, is the way Demodus translates the phrases used. And this sentiment, this yearning for normalcy, is echoed in the epilogue by the authorial voice character that LaRue creates to narrate the novel. And in fact, I've begun to crack into some of the more modern translations. I've been reading the one by Mireille Ribière, and in fact, she does use the word normal in those passages. Where Demodos says, like everybody else or like anybody, Ribière actually does translate those passages as using the word normal. But what's interesting when we get to the Lloyd Webber stage musical is that the Phantom there, the Lloyd Webber stage musical does not use the Phantom's name, does not call him Eric, it's just the Phantom. But in the final lair, in Act 2, Scene 9, the Phantom of the stage musical does not express a desire to be normal or to be like everybody else. Instead, he expresses and emphasizes a desire for compassion. So, right in the Down Once More part at the beginning of that scene, he says, hounded out by everyone, quote, hounded out by everyone, met with hatred everywhere, no kind word from anyone, no compassion anywhere, Christine, Christine, why, quote. And later in that scene, when Raoul arrives and asks the Phantom to show some compassion, the Phantom fires back very pointedly, quote, the world showed no compassion to me, quote. And whereas LaRue's authorial voice character in the epilogue says, quote, oh yes, we must needs pity the opera ghost, quote, the Phantom of the Lloyd Webber musical very pointedly rejects pity. Just before Raoul arrives, when he puts the veil on Christine, he says, quote, pity comes too late, quote. And then later, leading into the Point of No Return reprise, it gets a little buried in the counterpoint, but he says, quote, too late for prayers and useless pity, quote. So the Phantom of the stage musical very much does not want pity. He does not want to be pitied. He asks for compassion instead. And he's not in this scene asking to become normal either. Again, he's expressing a yearning for compassion instead. Now, there is a case for reading the beautiful white wedding dress that Christine wears in this scene and that we see on the mannequin of Christine back in Act 1 in Music of the Night. There's a case for reading the wedding dress as perhaps expressing a desire for normalcy on the Phantom's part. You could read it as representing his desiring to fit into the ideal of the bourgeois heterosexual marriage. But there are other elements that it seems to me at the very least counterbalance reading that out of the presence of the wedding dress in those scenes. First of all, as I said, there's an absence of any verbal expression of a desire for normalcy on the Phantom's part, and an emphasis on compassion, on the desire for compassion, and a rejection of pity instead. And then there's the space of the Phantom's lair itself. First off, there's the choice of lair as the word that the libretto uses for the Phantom's home. In the LaRue novel, it's referred to as the house on the lake, as Demodos translates it, or the lakeside retreat, as Mireille Ribière translates it. But the libretto of the stage musical calls it his lair. And that's an interesting choice of words. It's a double-edged word, because on one hand, it evokes the animal or the monstrous, because we think of, like, foxes having lairs, or dragons having lairs, or other kinds of beasts having lairs. But on the other hand, and at the same time, it also evokes the tradition of the romantic or the romanticized outlaw. Think Zorro, Scaramouche, the Highwayman, figures like that. So calling the Phantom's home his lair, subtly or maybe not so subtly, kind of situates the Phantom of the Stage Musical in that tradition. And in keeping with that, unlike in the LaRue novel, where, as I talked about last episode, much of the Phantom's home tries very hard to replicate bourgeois normalcy, except for the torture chamber, which is a very negative space, or his own bedroom, which, as I discussed last time, is a very ambivalent space. The lair, the Phantom's lair of the Stage Musical, is a very romantic space. You only see it in sketch. Much of it is left to the viewers, to the audience's imagination. But what you do see of it, you've got the organ covered with candles, you've got the lake covered with mist, with candles rising out of it, you've got the candelabras rising out of the lake and the mist, you've got the Phantom's throne. It's a very, as I said, a very romantic space. It is definitely not an attempt to replicate a normal, quote-unquote, normal bourgeois home. It's even got a portcullis evoking a castle. And so it's into this very magical, very romantic space, totally given over to art and music and creative self-expression, this space that the Phantom describes as, quote, the seat of sweet music's throne, unquote, that he brings Christine during the title song in Music of the Night. And in fact, in Music of the Night, he invites Christine to share this space with him. Quote, help me make the music of the night, unquote. And as he's describing this realm that he's created to her and inviting her to join him in it, there's what seems to me to be a very strong implication that it is a space outside of normalcy, that it is a space where the conventions of normalcy, the rules of normalcy, the criterion of normalcy do not apply. It's a space where other rules, where alternative criteria apply. Specifically, it's a space where the beauty of music and of creative self-expression is more important than the beauty of faces. And bonus points to any listeners out there who get what that's a reference to, tweet at the show or send me an email, and perhaps there'll be a nice surprise. Anyway, so yeah, he invites Christine to join him in, and in some sense to be his partner in, this sanctuary away from normalcy that judges the Phantom and finds him ugly and undesirable. And that's interesting, because it suggests, at least to me, that the stage version Phantom is a character, a person, who might be okay with not being normal, as long as he's not alone in it, as long as he's not isolated in it, as long as he's able to share it with someone. It's the isolation, it's the solitude that turns it from the seat of sweet music's throne into, quote, the prison of my mind, quote, and, quote, the dungeon of my black despair, quote, rather than the being abnormal in and of itself. So it seems to me, then, that the Stage Musical is lamenting the Phantom's never having found people who could accept him as he is, talent, face, and all, rather than lamenting the fact that he isn't and can't be normal, rather than wishing he could be normal. And this, combined with the musicals also criticizing society for shunning and excluding the Phantom for the way it treats people whom it deems abnormal, this, it seems to me, gives the Stage Musical a much more strongly critical position with regard to the whole idea of normal and normalcy. The Lloyd Webber musical seems able, perhaps, to imagine alternatives to normalcy, whereas the LaRue novel doesn't seem to be able to conceive of that, doesn't seem to be able to imagine that. And this is really interesting because, again, of the historical context. So back when LaRue was writing, this, as I talked about last episode, this whole idea of normalcy had come up quickly and it had become very powerful. It was in ascendancy when LaRue was writing, and it had become powerful enough to influence culture, like the arts, literature, and it had become powerful enough to influence law and policy. But by the time we get to the mid-1980s, when the Lloyd Webber musical comes on the scene, the whole idea of normalcy is starting to come under heavy fire. It's starting to be heavily criticized. So, for example, in the 50s, the 1950s, you have the beatnik generation, and then later in the 60s, you have the hippie generation, both criticizing the idea of normal for how it's being used to police behavior and to try to kind of squash people into the leave it to beaver, suburban family, married with children box, and to kind of squash and suppress creativity and other ways of living. So they're criticizing normalcy for the way it's being used as a form of social control. And then in the 70s, starting in the 70s, you have second wave feminism criticizing normalcy for the way that its idea of what is normal is based on masculinity, or rather on a certain kind of masculinity. And they're criticizing how that standard of what's normal is being used to justify the oppression of women. And then you have black activists, particularly black feminist activists, calling attention to and criticizing how what was deemed normal, especially at that time, was very much based on whiteness as well, and how that was used to justify the oppression of black people, particularly black women. And then you have the gay rights movement, what would become the LGBTQIA+, etc. movement, calling attention to and pointing out how, quote-unquote, normal is defined as heterosexual, is defined as straight, and how that is used to oppress and marginalize gay, queer, etc. people. And you have the emergence of the disability rights movement as well, which really begins to question why society is only designed to accommodate bodies defined as quote-unquote normal, i.e. able-bodied people, and really looking at how that marginalizes disabled people. And you have the emergence of the psychiatric survivor movement, too, which asks similar questions with regard to minds and to quote-unquote mental health. And while not all of these movements, or not all parts of these movements, because of course they're all very internally diverse as well, while not all of them criticize or critique the notion of normal directly, they all very definitely ask the question, how do we define what is normal and who has the power to decide? And how do those definitions affect people? How do those definitions affect people's lives? How do those definitions affect who has power in society and who doesn't? And the idea of normal is also being critiqued, criticized, kind of from the other side as well, because the 1980s is, of course, the era of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, the emergence of the so-called Me Inc. generation. And of course, Margaret Thatcher is famously, or infamously, depending on how you look at it, quoted as saying, quote, "There is no society, only individuals and their families," quote. And so there's this idea coming from the sort of neoliberal, free market, laissez-faire, unfettered capitalism, deregulated capitalism side as well, that argues that normalcy equals mediocrity, and that that holds back the creative or entrepreneurial genius. And that idea of normal as mediocrity holding back creative genius, that's a theme that runs through a lot of 80s film in particular, but a lot of 80s popular culture. Those of us old enough to remember the 80s will remember that being a theme in a lot of 80s pop culture. So this is very much the context into which Phantom appears, into which the Lloyd Webber stage musical Phantom appears in 1986. Now, I'm not suggesting that Andrew Lloyd Webber or Charles Hart or Hal Prince or any of the original creative team that put Phantom together were directly influenced by any of these movements. Although I would be interested to know if there was some feminist influence on Gillian Lynn and Maria Bjornsson, given that they were women in what I would imagine would have been historically very much male-dominated fields of choreography and set design in music theater. But with the exception of that, I'm not suggesting, necessarily, that any of these movements directly influence the creation of Phantom. Rather, I'm suggesting they had an indirect influence, kind of like how, after 2011, suddenly the notion of the 99% versus the 1% was everywhere in media and popular culture and even ordinary conversation, because Occupy had kind of exploded it onto the scene and had made that discussion of class power, whatever side of that discussion you're on, they made that discussion of class power an actual discussion in the culture where it had not been before. So, yeah, I'm suggesting that all those movements I referred to before on the left and on the right had an indirect influence like that on Phantom rather than a direct one, because they made it thinkable, they made it culturally possible to question the idea of normalcy and to question how what is normal is arrived at, even if you weren't directly involved in those movements. Now, that's not to say that they made it safe to question normalcy and how it was arrived at, how it is arrived at, especially if you're criticizing it, critiquing it from a position of being marginalized, of having less social power. So, for example, if you're a person of color or a queer person or a disabled person or a trans person or even a woman, a female-identified, female-presenting person. But those movements did at least make it possible, make it culturally thinkable to make those critiques and ask those questions. And as a result, we can see that questioning, we can see that spirit of critique making its way into the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical. We can see the stage musical, as I said before, not just criticizing society for the way it treats people labeled abnormal, but wishing the Phantom could have found acceptance, could have found people who could accept him, talent, genius, face, and all, rather than simply wishing that he could somehow have been normal. And we can even, perhaps, see the stage musical as being able to, as I said before, imagine alternatives to what's conventionally defined as normal. And I think for generations who've grown up in the wake of second wave feminism, the gay rights movement, the civil rights movement, Black liberation, and, of course, the disability rights and psychiatric survivor movements, it seems to me that the presence of that spirit of critique and of being able to imagine alternatives in the stage musical is a great deal of what gives the show its incredible power. That's a significant part of what makes it so compelling and what got all us fans hooked and keeps us hooked. And I have to say that though I couldn't have articulated that when I first became a fan and for many years of my fanship, looking back on it, yeah, that was definitely the case for me. That was definitely a huge part of why the musical, why the ALW stage musical spoke to me the way it did. Because many of us have had unpleasant experiences in the education system or sometimes in the medical or psychiatric systems of people trying to normalize us, often involving psychological or even physical violence and resulting in a lot of trauma. But then there's Phantom saying, along with these many social movements, no, you should be able to be accepted, to find acceptance, even if your body and your mind don't or can't conform to what's considered normal. And if you're being made to feel otherwise, then it's society that's wrong, not you. And that's a very powerful and liberating message. And I do read the Lloyd Webber stage musical as containing that kind of critique of normalcy, rather than the more neoliberal, Me Inc., hyper-individualism-based kind of critique of normalcy that I referenced earlier. Because although the musical does contain references to the idea of normalcy as mediocrity, think Act 2, Scene 3, the second note scene, where the Phantom is commenting on the mediocrities of the opera popular company, and also think the character of Carlotta in the stage musical, who is often interpreted as a sort of mediocre talent who thinks she's all that. That's very much counterbalanced, and I would even go so far as to say overshadowed, by the emphasis in Music of the Night and in Act 2, Scene 9, The Final Lair, on companionship and connection. As I argued earlier, in Music of the Night, he's inviting Christine to share in the sanctuary that he's created. And of course, in The Final Lair, the transformative moment is when Christine says to the Phantom, quote, "You are not alone," unquote. So it's very much framing hyper-isolation as a problem, as a bad thing, as a negative. And beyond that, for all his talent and genius, the Phantom never loses his outsider status. He is not, for example, the equivalent of the high school nerd who's bullied and rejected but ultimately makes good and becomes a rock star or a famous tech entrepreneur. Both of those frequent tropes of 80s and 90s pop culture. He remains an outsider, and I read Music of the Night, in fact, as him seeking companionship in his outsider status that he's transformed into a sanctuary, perhaps even, question mark, his outlaw status. And in that, his quote-unquote genius, his artistic talent, his creative self-expression provide not a way out of outsider status into success in mainstream society, but instead they provide, in fact, ways to survive psychically and to find and create dignity for himself in that outsider status. And they're how he creates that sanctuary. And that's far more in keeping with the marginalized experiences voiced and expressed by the social movements referenced earlier than it is with the neoliberal, Me Inc. generation, hyper-individualist narrative or fantasy of busting out of the mediocrity of normalcy to achieve wild success through one's creative genius. And that's something I plan to talk about in greater depth in a future episode, perhaps around the time of Disability Pride. So yeah, I hope you've enjoyed this discussion of the Lloyd Webber stage musical, and I hope you enjoyed the similar discussion of the LaRue novel last episode. And I imagine that this is a topic for both versions of the story that I'll come back to at some point as I do more research and deepen my analysis and gain even more perspectives on it. And as I said back at the beginning of this episode, I'll put the quotes from the musical that I referred to in the show notes with act and scene citation references so you can look them up and see them in their context in the show. And I'll also put links and or bibliographic information for some of the sources I'm referring to, some of the sources I'm using on the historical context that I talked about as well. But, like last time, please bear with me if it takes me a bit of time to get the show notes up. For one thing, it takes a while to get them all typed out and edited properly. And for another thing, unfortunately, I'm having technical difficulties of the accessibility variety with the blog post form where I post the show notes on the podcast website. So most of the form is okay, but unfortunately the body text edit field where I actually put the main text of the show notes in, for some reason my screen reader and it are not getting along. And I managed it last time by copy and pasting from a word processor document, But for last episode's show notes, I didn't need to actually include any links. But for this episode's show notes, I will want to include at least a couple of links, and that means being able to actually get into the body of the post, the blog post, and edit, which I'm unable to do right now because of the screen reader issues. Now, I have obviously contacted tech support at Fireside, my hosting service, about that, and I have to say, to their credit, they've been great. They understand the problem, and they're really willing to fix it. So I have to say, yeah, kudos and full marks to them for being really great about it when an accessibility issue is brought to their attention and being willing to get right on it and try to fix it as fast as possible. But I don't know how long as fast as possible is going to be. Hopefully not long, but yeah, that will hold up the works a bit in terms of getting the show notes for this episode posted. Sorry about that. In the meantime, I will be getting to work on episode 4, and hopefully I will have it posted sometime around the 1st of August. Now, I know I every time say that I'm going to have the next episode out by a certain time, and then things run behind, so yeah. But hopefully, sooner or later, I will actually get onto the schedule that I originally wanted to be on, and actually be able to get on that schedule and stay on it. That would be nice. So hopefully this will be the time when that happens, finally, because I have what I hope will be a really interesting and hopefully exciting, hopefully not too off-pissing, episode for everyone next time, because next time I want to talk about, I want to compare the stage musical, the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical, and the 2004 film. And I know that's going to be controversial because fans tend to either love the 2004 film or hate it. So yeah, next episode you'll get to hear what I think of it. In the meantime, of course, you can follow this episode on Twitter or tweet at me, at the show, at ITL Podcast. Or you can send an old-fashioned email to inthislabyrinth@yahoo.com. And I would absolutely love to hear your feedback. I'd absolutely love to hear what you all think of these first 3 episodes and the discussions I've had in them so far. You can also, of course, like or follow the Facebook page for the show, which searching In This Labyrinth on Facebook should bring up. The page is called In This Labyrinth Podcast. And you can also join the Facebook group for this show, which is called In This Labyrinth, The Phantom of the Opera in Eric's Times and Hours. And searching In This Labyrinth on Facebook should bring up it too. And yeah, feel free to join the Facebook group as well. I set it up so there'd be a more interactive space for sharing and discussion, as well as just me putting out updates at you all. And of course, you can visit the podcast website at http://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm/. And there's a link to the Facebook page on the podcast website, and there's a link to the Facebook group from the Facebook page. So hopefully everything should be nice and easy to find so folks can share and discuss and participate. So with all that, I really hope you've enjoyed this episode and this discussion, and I hope you'll tune back in and join me next time for episode 4 when we talk about the Jerick. And last but not least, copyright notice. The intro music and content of this podcast are copyright to me, Phantom Femme, and the wonderful podcast artwork is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org.